As I knelt to the ground, the beam of the flashlight confirmed my fears. Randy was dead, blackish blood seeping out of his mouth. I ran my hand through his fur one last time and gritted my teeth. It's one thing to ruin my crops, and it's another damn thing to kill my dog. I swung the flashlight around, knowing the killer wasn't too far off. Randy's barking had been abruptly cut off only a few minutes prior. I hadn't thought whoever was poisoning my crops would be back so soon. It was only a few days ago that all my barley had up and wilted overnight, golden stalks turning black and covered in pustules. I had leashed Randy outside to keep watch, but he had snapped his chain and bolted off into the field when I barely had grabbed my flashlight and rifle. I had taken off, calling Randy's name as fast as I could, running towards the field, doing my best to jump the small stream that divided my property in two, but it wasn't fast enough. But I knew whoever killed my dog couldn't be that far away. As I stood, I noticed a strange toxic smell and I winced. It smelled like melted plastic mixed with sulfur. I swung the light around and that's when I saw deep, gigantic hoof prints in the mud. I realized that the killer must be on horseback, so I sprinted off, not thinking about the fact that there would be no way that I could realistically catch up with a mounted rider. But after seeing Randy lying there, I had to try. I slowed my pace, breathless, as I saw a figure in the moonlight close to the sea cliffs. I extinguished my flashlight, not wanting to give away my position. The figure was seemingly just standing there, the horse standing still and grazing. I collected my breath and slowly moved towards the man and the horse. As I got closer, I got chills when I realized that the horse wasn't eating the grass, but breathing onto it, wilting it in barren patches. And it was then that I realized that as I had tracked the killer, I had no cover at all, and I had been following a muddy path of wilted grass that led me directly to the mounted figure, and also led directly back towards me. At that moment, the clouds cleared, and that's when I saw it. It wasn't a man riding a horse, but a man grafted to the back of the horse. Neither the man half nor the horse half had any skin, its body rippling with exposed muscles and yellowish veins. The horse legs all had webbed fins, and the man's sinewy arms were unlike any normal proportions, reaching all the way to the ground. I immediately raised my rifle and fired. And I saw that I had hit the monstrosity in the head, but whatever it was, it didn't die. It merely let loose an unholy scream and came barreling towards me. I turned and ran, and I could hear the monster closing the considerable lead I had. I didn't dare turn back, but could almost feel those unnaturally long arms outstretched right behind me. And I kept running and I saw my house in the near distance. I was about to leap over the stream when I was suddenly lifted into the air. The monster's enormously long arms spun me around and I was face to face with the monster's glowing red eyes. The head was gigantic and its breath burned my lungs. I gagged and coughed and I tried to free myself, but the monster's grip was too tight. I looked the flayed creature in the eyes and all I could think of was to say, "My name is Rick Kitagawa, and this is the Inner Monster Podcast." The Nuckalavi is a watery demon that comes to us from an archipelago in the northern isles of Scotland called the Orkney Islands. In Orcadian folklore, this creature is a nightmarish mix of equine and human parts. The Nuckalavi is described as, according to the only first-hand account of the creature, as sort of looking like a horse with a rider fused to the horse's back. The upper humanoid part has no legs, but its arms are long enough to reach the ground, and the head is also quite large and rolls back and forth. The lower equine part also has its own horse head, but this horse head only has one glowing red eye. The legs are all finned, as it's a water demon after all, and the horse head breathes a toxic gas that wilts plants and is said to be the source of poor crops. It can also transmit disease to normal horses, as it did when the Orcadians started up the burning of seaweed for the production of the soda ash industry. Overall, the Nekolavi is one mean demon, the most spiteful of all of the northern Scottish demons, and you can tell how mean it is merely by the fact that it has no skin. The entire thing is flayed with black blood pumping through exposed yellow veins. And there are only two things that can contain the Nekolavi. The first is the Mithra o' the Sea, a benevolent spirit of Orcadian lore who, in the summer, drags the Nekolavi back into the ocean and traps it there to minimize its damage to humans. And the second thing is fresh water. As a creature from the sea, it cannot pass bodies of fresh water, and the only human to live to tell the tale of an experience with this creature managed to survive by barely making it across the river, and thus out of the Nekolavi's reach. I find the fact that you have this crazy, horrific demon horse human thing that can spread the plague, held back by a stream, incredibly fascinating. Often in mythology and stories in general, we often create huge monstrosities who only have a single weakness that's also incredibly common and situational, but also incredibly powerful. This narrative device really allows the storyteller to give the hero some sort of a chance to fight back and win. After all, if vampires didn't die in the sun, or werewolves couldn't be killed by silver, or Medusa wasn't killable by just showing her a mirror, what chances would the human heroes have to slay these formidable, super-powered creatures? And so today, I want to talk about the power of boundaries. And back in episode 14, when I talked about Krampus, I really focused on how to be generous with oneself. And today, I wanted to talk about a somewhat non-intuitive way of thinking about how to be generous to others. And this way of being generous is creating firm boundaries with people. Personally, I grew up with very little boundaries as a child. I always performed well in school without any prodding or coaxing. I was generally pretty well behaved, and thus I was given a lot of freedoms and benefits of the doubt, and punishments like no video games or television were usually forgot about after a day or two. While this might sound like an awesome childhood, I did grow up without really understanding the consequences of my actions, and this lack of boundaries has been something that I've had to work on a lot as an adult. Whether it's being firm with my budget, even when I find something I really want to buy, or telling my partner that I'm currently prioritizing a project over spending time with her, or telling a client maybe that I have hard boundaries about my time that I spend with my partner. These can be difficult situations if you haven't practiced setting and sticking to boundaries. For me, it's often difficult to tell others or even myself no, which is really what setting boundaries are. It can seem easier to capitulate and give in and not quote-unquote rock the boat, but really all this does is often kick the problem down the road to future you. It might seem easier at the time to give in, but setting firm boundaries is often the more difficult but generous thing to do. And so these might be somewhat extreme examples about how telling someone no can be generous, but telling an addict that no, they cannot have access to your booze is the generous thing to do. Preventing your tween from making a chat roulette account is a generous thing to do. Throwing your child across the river so a Nekolavi doesn't kill them is a generous thing to do. And especially with people who cannot make boundaries for themselves, creating boundaries for them is often a generous act that can be born out of kindness and care that can prevent them from doing harm to themselves or exposing them to harm. And so boundaries are hard. Often it can feel like even though we're concerned about the well-being of ourselves and others, yet telling someone no often feels like a mean thing to do. There's especially a lot of pressure put on women around being quote-unquote nice, which is really the patriarchal code word for the belief that women should put others' needs over their own. But Shannon Weber's book, Show Up Hard, offers a great framework for thinking about boundaries. While you should just go and read her book, which is linked in the show notes, the basic premise is that we need to strike a balance between not caring at all and the opposite side of getting enmeshed and tangled up in the other party's feelings. It's all about finding the sweet spot of being empathetic, yet not tying your fates together. It's what Shannon calls being a compassionate witness. It's being able to care for others, but also know when you need to draw a firm boundary and understand that other people's lives are other people's lives, and it shouldn't overlap too much with your own. Boundaries can even help you manage yourself. You might need to have boundaries with yourself to keep from procrastinating on a business pitch by watching The Evil Dead a 10th time while eating vegan ice cream on the couch. Or you might be procrastinating on recording a podcast episode by playing games on your phone, which of course totally didn't happen today for this podcast. Yeah, definitely not. And a real example of boundaries with oneself was when I recently got invited to start playing League of Legends with a group of people. I wanted to play, but I also thought back to when I joined a guild in World of Warcraft and nearly ruined my life by letting the game consume me. So this time, I accepted the offer with a strict caveat of time boxing the activity and limiting game time to one day a week. It felt really weird, as if I was turning down a great offer, but they were, to my surprise, incredibly understanding and excited that I'd even be able to play. And experiences like this often make me wonder about how often the stories we tell ourselves about the other person gets in the way of us doing what's best for everyone. I imagine that my peers would be upset that I didn't want to play more, but actually valued that I had created some constraints for our playtime. And I think this is why the notion of asking for payment has historically been really scary for me. I would start layering my own flawed behaviors around money onto them. What if the other person doesn't want to give it to me, but does so out of feeling bad? What if they buy my art because they pity me so much that even though they can't afford it, they buy it anyway? What if this business owner doesn't really need coaching but hires me because she feels like my feelings would be hurt if she turns me down? I know those thoughts sound completely ridiculous, but those are all real fears of mine, irrational or not. And they seem far-fetched, but as someone who personally has donated money to charities when I didn't yet have enough savings for rent the next month, I can easily project my past lack of boundaries and poor decision-making onto others. And among the coaches I hang out with, we often talk about leaving the success and the failure with the students. Coaching can be incredibly powerful, but only so much as the coached individual wants to make a change. So while I stand by the value of coaching and how powerful it can be, ultimately it's up to the individual person being coached to change their life. By allowing that success or failure to lie with the student, you're really creating the necessary boundary of becoming someone who is unleashing others rather than pushing them forward. I think the idea of letting others be responsible for their own actions and decisions is important, even outside the coach-coachy world. It's an important boundary for physical therapists and doctors of all stripes. If a patient doesn't do their exercise or take their prescribed medicine, or even if they do, how is that the doctor's failure or success? If a lawyer's client decides to get up and punch the judge, is that really the lawyer's fault? Perhaps short-term, forcing a patient to take their medicine or physically restraining a violent offender might be better, but then those people would never really have to learn that they need to take responsibility for their own actions and that life has consequences for harmful behavior. Creating boundaries is a generous act both for you as well as others. They are incredibly important to make sure that not only are you taking care of yourself, but that you're providing people with the help that they really need to move forward in life. So I ask you, what boundary can you set that you've been laxing on? And what's something that you can commit to standing firm about? That's it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening to the Inner Monster podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to check out all of our other episodes wherever you get your podcasts or visit innermonsterpodcast.com. And if you feel so inclined, please spread the word and share this with a friend, or leave a review, or subscribe to get the podcast each week, every Inner Monster Monday. And now, a quick word from our sponsors. If you want to hear Inner Monster podcast episodes before anyone else, consider joining my Patreon at patreon.com/rickkitagawa, where you can get ad-free episodes, discounts on creepy art, and even coaching packages. That's patreon.com/rickkitagawa. I hope to see you there. Thank you so much, and I hope you have a monstrous day.